us, and the folks are going to, after we break formally, are going to be hanging out, so there'll be even more time to ask more questions. But I will ask questions from the audience. Because I felt that you guys did such an amazing job of talking about decentralized, you know, authorship, impact, engagement beyond user-generated content, critical relationships, process, outreach. I'm gonna limit my question to one sort of big one that's for all of you, and then kind of open it up. I was most interested in hearing one thing I didn't hear that I'd like to hear a little bit more about is because these approaches to storytelling, communication, whether they're aesthetic, whether they have outreach or social mission agendas, whether they be marketing or more commercial ventures or cause-related or purely entertainment, a curious thing that's happening is that the roles of designer, producer, director, owner, distributor, author, and so on, are becoming very muddled in what I think is a really interesting fashion. So what is the impact in terms of projects moving forward based on that kind of muddling, not just around the composition of teams, but in terms of like creative control and moving things forward? Nick, why don't you start with it, but it's for everyone.
So I was at Sundance last week, and I ended up, because I advised the New Frontiers part of the festival, and I speak to a lot of new media people there, and this was like bouncing around a lot. And I think the general understanding of ownership of a project, like a transmedial project, has to live in some sense with the brand owner in some way. Like, someone has to have initiated this idea and have control over it. And if you don't have that kind of relationship, then the project will be hell. Because you have all... As you start to develop a transmedial project, knowing how to make a film and knowing how to make an iPhone app have nothing to do with each other. So likely you have two different people doing those things, and each one of those people, if you're doing something well, is probably quite creative and, you know, has a lot of interesting ideas around your project, especially if your project has something hot about it. They're going to want to, like, do something cool. And that's going to be a fight at some point. And so it's really important that there's an establishment very early on of, like, who those relationships are. And I think as... I feel really terrible because I didn't think I'd have to talk about this anywhere anytime soon. But, like, there are buzzings around about people starting to enter the idea of sponsoring and publishing work like this that I was starting to probe. And what the attitude that those people had was that you could form collectives that could be, like, interesting collectives of people, but that someone in that would be an idea initiator who could have some ownership over that. And that relationship could then become... like the sort of foreground for it. But what I would say, as someone who makes games and has worked with a lot of different partners, absolutely do not try to do everything yourself. It's like a really terrible, terrible idea. There's something that you're probably good at, and you should do that. And then you should find someone who's good at the other stuff and have them do that. And it's certainly more fun to work with other people, especially people who are smart. But you also save yourself like enormously nightmarish headaches about learning fields that you don't really know anything about when there are tons of experts lying around who are likely to help you. And I can't, you know, I've talked about this a lot, and I've published articles about this, that like you should never assume that you know these fields that you wander into, and you're always better off finding people who can help you do them rather than doing them yourselves.
So we actually had two filmmakers following us, and they were actually really close friends of ours. And the question was, what's our role in the film, and what's their role in the blog? So we had to set that up right ahead and earlier, like right in the beginning. Like we were just subjects in that regard, and they own complete ownership of the film and whatever they're shooting, and we're running the blog, and they weren't allowed to you know, be in the front seats at all. They just had to be in the back seats. So I think it's really important to set those roles ahead of time. And, you know, just so you don't have any confusions.
I think what you said is right on, but basically, the interesting right now is you can do anything. Like, all these roles, one person can do, and you might not be able to build a game, but you can actually teach yourself for free online. You can do almost anything. The problem is you can't do it all. Mm-hmm. So you just got to build that team that can do it with you, and I know of three different collectives coming together right now around this, where people are taking on those different roles, and so I think that's one of the ways it's going, and I think that's good for the field as well. So,
And Takahi, you mentioned, when you made your point around the critical relationships that were occurring during the process, I found that to be a really kind of prescient point, where it's not like, we're working behind the scenes, we're creating this perfect story, and here it is out into the world, come to our theater and see it. Mm-hmm. But when you're gathering a story, all sorts of things are happening. And obviously, those happenings, to capture that or to deal with it, there's a lot of nimbleness, and there's a lot of different kinds of activities in terms of capturing and then doing something with those kind of stories that swirl around a larger story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, for Granito, I mean, that's a tiny team. I mean, there's a film, meaning, you know, as a producer, as a director, as an editor, all of what comes with it. But when it came to the Granito project, I worked closely with the director in the beginning, so that was how we did it. I actually had the director, when we hashed it out, just like conceptualized it, like the director, myself, and we actually had someone from, actually Enrique Berset from Human Rights Watch, who kind of does digital initiatives at, he does digital initiatives at Human Rights Watch. So that was kind of an informal advisor to kind of what kind of steps we're taking. He's not as involved right now. But once we got the funding, which a lot of the work around raising funds is done by Patros, the producer of the film, he's very good at setting those things up. So he's entirely doing that all the time. And I was a designer working very closely with actually his son, Alejandro, who runs multiple websites as such. So he's more of a manager, and then we have a developer working on it. And then we have this entire team out in Guatemala who are collecting the stories. But a lot of it comes from sort of, I think because of the way that we were gathering content was kind of not that dissimilar to a way that you kind of scout and go out and shoot a film. It's kind of the work ethic that happens at a documentary outfit totally worked, because they, you know, like production assistants, they were just like out doing it, communicating, engaging, organizations all the time. So they were kind of used to doing that. The only thing is in the equation is that you added a designer and a website manager kind of person on top of it, I think.
I'll add on one kind of partial question before opening it up. In terms of impact, and lots of folks talked about impact, and obviously goals and measurement around impact can come in a lot of packages and can drive the motivation for a project, the funding for a project, and also the stakeholders of these complex composite teams are going to be looking at different indicators of why did I do this, what's my end goal, or what are the goals in between, you know, whether it's unique visitors on a website, numbers of participants, numbers of comments, numbers of people adding content if that's part of the game, or if it's supporting a feature film and you're getting people into. So there's a whole host of metrics, and that's an enormous conversation that obviously we've touched on and can go on in forever and ever and ever. I'll just open up the question to everyone in terms of what you see ahead of us in this movement, what does success look like in the future around this potential, whether it's a project that is in process now or one you might imagine really hitting the bullseye in terms of impact, and what might that look like? It's vague, but it's like a back casting question.
Money. Sustainability to some degree.
Sustainability. I mean, so abilities for platforms to have a model so that they are monetizing in some way to go on in perpetuity.
I mean, I'm kind of running up against this myself, but because I'm looking at like a couple of these kind of projects that come out of a film and has an outreach program that has like Granito Waiting Room. The problem is that you have the money, the budget to be like, okay, execute upon this, right? So you design it, you come up with the content strategy, and you develop it, and then you have the thing. But then like the maintenance cost is like a whole other, and like it's not there, and it needs continuous funding, which kind of a lot of filmmakers who are doing this are running up against, because they get the model is that you get money for the film, you finish the film, you have some amount for outreach, and that's it. But these projects live on forever.
So moderation becomes an issue. I mean, there's a person sitting there looking at it, capturing things, updating that person's time or person's time and infrastructure.
You guys must run into that kind of.
Yeah.
You're doing that, so it's probably not.
Yeah, like initially when we started the project, I think we got really wrapped up in just looking at like visitors and page views and things like that, but it didn't really, you know, stay true to our core nature of the project being grassroots and that connection. I mean, we started to focus less on page views and more on just the quality of engagement or people leaving not only comments or likes, because, okay, if you have thousands of likes, it doesn't really tell you anything about the quality of the project, but we're looking at the comment threads and the conversations people were having on their Facebook pages and posting on other people's Facebook pages, and as we traveled promoting the project and seeing all the hands and how people found out about it and sharing not only the stories that they like, but their own personal stories, that to us was our measure of success. While people are really talking about this, because we don't want passive people that just click a button and like it or just visit it. We want people to really immerse themselves in this world and talk about it with their friends and, you know, suggest stories. And that's how we were able to determine our success model is really just the quality of the engagement rather than the quantity.
But also something just to note on what you were saying was that it was really important for us to also be talking back with them. So we got a lot of emails, and Aman was amazing at responding back to them immediately. And I think that's something that I also noticed a lot of filmmakers. I think the old 20th century model was there's this like glass wall, or there's like this, you don't necessarily interact with the filmmakers. But I feel like that has to change a little bit now in this 21st century, where people want to know what's up with the directors, and people will feel a little bit, they'll be more involved, and they'll feel like they have something at stake when they were part of the project. So I think that was also something that was really cool, that people started feeling invested because they knew who we were, and we were sort of also the narrative threads in a certain way.
Mm-hmm.
And so the other part of this, I think that's, I agree with everything everybody said, the other piece of this has to do with like actually metrically judging the
mm-hmm.
effects of things,
mm-hmm.
and this is something that's a very big thing in education. I don't know if documentaries actually deal with this at all, but like games deal with this constantly, where like, because games kind of fall into this testing category, and we test things like crazy in this country, and so like there are these huge, elaborate, complicated, and ever-shifting protean standards that get applied to what you do, and because the educational system in this country is so desperate for a solution to what is a horrific and way more extensive problem than anybody ever really recognizes, is like test it and try to find something that works, and so those parameters get like really, really studied. And I think there's the nice thing about things like games and digital content is that it's actually pretty easy to track stuff. It's like that's what computers do very well, is, you know, record when you clicked and put that into a database. So we get a lot of this data, but there's a lot of questions about like what's relevant, what actually shows impact. And certainly in the field of serious games, we saw this wave that went through it that was like in the early days, the Darfur, what I call the Darfur is dying days, like you'd have games that came out and they got a big splash because MTV would push them, and then it would be like, wow, millions of people have played this game and nothing has happened in Darfur. So like, so there was this sort of like, there was this sort of recoiling in the serious games industry because the groups that were involved were pure, it was all grant-funded advocacy work. Like no one was doing this on their own. It was all just money that came into the space. So MacArthur and groups like that were just like, well, we want to see something actually happen. And that led to this drive towards a sort of metrics approach of impact. And I'm not, it's just an interesting space to be in. And if you're gonna pursue, especially around education, but anything around like large foundational work that has a digital component, there's gonna be a pressure on you to provide some kind of metrics of like what you've done. And so that needs to be part of your strategy from day one. And consulting with either an educational expert or someone who has an expertise in the nonprofit world is, I would advise you to do very seriously, because that's a make or break moment for you, and providing a good argument that you've had impact can be the thing that can keep your work going, can keep your work funded, and can get you more work in the future.
Mm-hmm.
Right. The only thing I would add to that is that you need to get out in front of that and define your metrics
mm-hmm.
to your funders and other
mm-hmm.
people, because they'll come up with all kinds of really stupid metrics. But if you can up front say, it doesn't matter that we have a great clout score or a million views, which may matter, but just, you know, mm-hmm. as an example, what really matters to us is the types of people we're getting in front of. So we may only be in front of 50 people, but they were all politicians. Or, you know, if you can define it from the beginning for the funders, you'll have a lot more success, because otherwise they'll just want to know, did you get into Sundance and did you get a million people to watch it?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And I'll just add to that, and we can talk more after I ask for questions from you guys. I've worked on a couple of projects that, specifically Shelbyville, which It's about immigration, integration, and MacArthur is putting up some money for them to do a long-term impact study over years, and their approach to that has even been very well designed by saying, we're going to pick two cities and pick a group of key indicators and start to track them very slowly. Again, it's not something, it's not clicks in a day or we had a million hits, so there is a real invested, I wouldn't say concern around this, but I think that people are open to designing more interesting ways to look at what impact really means, what is value and how do we measure it. With that, we can talk, you can ask me more about it later after we break, but now I want to kind of turn it over to you and see what kind of questions you all have for our guests. We must have some.
I have a question kind of related to, you know, what does success look like? And I guess this is less for transmedia projects that have a film attached, because then they can go to Sundance and win awards and everyone knows what that looks like. But if it is something more like the NFB kind of projects, where there is no film, and maybe not even a game actually, because I feel like even there people kind of know what that looks like, then how do you get them, you know, how do you get them out into the world? Because there's very few festivals that show that kind of work, and you know, for the NFB, I mean, it is a little bit of an ivory tower because it's, you know, it's a lot of government funding. So if you have a project that lives, say, just on a website, how do you make it, you know, like what is the platform that, what does distribution, I guess, look like for that?
Well, that's what yours was to begin with.
So Tyler Perry, I don't like his movies necessarily, but he did something that was really cool where he said, fuck it, to Hollywood. And he said, I'm going to do my own thing. And if you, you know, and I've got an audience that will watch it. And a lot of black middle class people loved his stuff. So for us, it was like, okay, you know what? We're going to do this. And for us, it was the Muslims, right? Like the Muslim Americans and Muslims around. We're very savvy people. We're, you know, we narrow cast. We don't watch Fox News. You know, we know what we like, and that's what we do. So for us, it was, we knew our audience, and it was important that we engage with them. So, but I think the test of success for us, because we tried our best to never have an agenda when we did this project. It was really important that whatever we did, it was always engaging, and it was always artful. Like, it had something that somebody can look at it, and if you hate Muslims, you can at least go like, okay, that's a well-written article, or that's a damn good photo. That if they could at least agree to that, then I think we were doing something well, which I think we did. So for us, for us, success kind of became being able to actually communicate with a lot of these, like these worlds that we wouldn't be able to. Like, for example, Time Magazine. We did photo essays for them. So for us, it became like this little Muslim project being able to reach what would be considered mainstream, right? So I think for Tyler Perry, if we're to sort of channel that world or use that as a metaphor, for him to break into Hollywood or start getting his movies out there in his own terms would be success. So I guess for us, it was just to see that we've got this one audience and then being able to propel as art or whatever to other audiences.
But you started really, like, from your talk that you just gave, and it sounds like you started with a very small audience.
Yeah,
you started with the immediate, probably younger Muslim audience that thought this idea was cool to go around New York.
Yeah.
And then you probably weren't reaching out to, like, the rap blogs until a later date.
Yeah,
it was starting where you know.
Yeah, it was a very jackass idea. We didn't even have a plan of like making this a project. It was just something that we were doing, and our friends were like, "Hey, we want to see where you guys are going." And so then it kind of snowballed. Then we realized that people are actually, you know, reading this, and that's when we took advantage of that and started to engage the audience a little bit more and actively, you know, try to do that. But initially, it was just, "Hey, let's just see what happens," and we kind of had a "let's just see what happens" mindset going into it, and we continue to do that. You know, we just do what makes sense. When people want this, you know, we'll give them a little bit more and kind of, you know, layer by layer, unveiling more.
Jesse, you want to jump in?
Yeah, I mean, I had a question in regards to that. What were some of the key milestones? Like, was it exponential or was it a snowball effect?
Yeah. Okay, so there were a couple of key milestones. For the 2010 project, it was, okay, so the first 2009, it was Jeannie Jardin from Boing Boing. Having partnerships with certain blogs goes a long way. So Jeannie became a big champion of ours. I'm not sure if y'all know Boing Boing, but it's one of the most visited blogs on lifestyle and culture. And so when she got on board as a champion of us, it really helped us become sort of people that some people listen to. So I think from that point, that was one of our first milestones in 2009. Our next milestone was when CNN put us on the front page of their site. And we like you know, just hit up in a lot of like a lot like you know the amount of emails we got and the attention we got, which is kind of interesting because like especially like in our community, as much as we don't like you know we always bash CNN, we bash all these things. To us in the Muslim community, that is legitimacy, right? It is Western media outlets, you know, that's legitimacy. Like getting on Al Jazeera, who cares? I didn't get on Al Jazeera. So that was like legitimacy in you know in our circles as well as a larger, broader American circle. So I think that was one of the big milestones. And 2011, of course, for us, we wanted to really, if we did have a little bit of a strategy, it was to try to get these like more niche blogs to show that we do matter and we do got, you know, a broad amount of like, you know, whether it's photos or video or whatever that we do that we are innovating, I guess. So I'm not sure. Hopefully that answers.
Yeah.
Okay.
Just a hand up here.
Yeah, I just had a question about that speaks to the distribution question. I was wondering what people thought about apps. I come from like the ebook world and you know, there's all these different platforms and there's kind of a mechanism for sharing content in that way, but I'm wondering if you've had, you know, good experiences or bad experiences with apps or creating apps for your projects? Or if apps are dead or...
Well, I think this is broader just in regards to transmedia. I think with a lot of creative projects, I call it like the MTV Cribs approach. It's like, oh shit, check this out. I got drop-down menus, I got apps, I got this, check this out. You're on HTML5, I'm on HTML6. It's not even out yet. You know, that kind of thing. And so it's really getting an understanding of what the technology can do and what is the purpose of your story. And so I think people think of the technology first and the art second. It should be the other way around. And so apps make sense when, okay, how will this get the story... how this engages people with the story that I want to get across. Like, when we did our app, what we did is we realized that on the blog, people just love to look at photos and love to look at, you know, stories. And as we were traveling, they wanted to know where we were going. And so we tailored the app to do that. Rather than just having a blog, a mobile version of our blog, because people can already do that, we created an app that, you know, people can scroll through photos, they can find out when we're speaking in their area and that kind of thing. And so it's a matter of just understanding what these different mediums are capable of doing and seeing how that, you know, can fit into the story that you're trying to tell.
I think the smartest way to think about Apple and Facebook, for that matter, relative to other medium, is that Apple is not Whole Foods. Apple is Walmart, right? Apple did not curate you, does not care about you, does not like have any interest in you. They're going to look at your thing. It's like, is this porn? Is this virus? No, shelf. And that's it. And like and every so often they'll pick something out that they like, and you get blessed by the gods of Apple, and then suddenly like you'll see more stuff happen. But that's like most people don't end up in that place. So you end up with these crazy power laws of success that I think typically exist in media content, but exist like crazy in those spaces. So I would argue that if you're going to pursue an app strategy or even a social strategy, like a Facebook strategy, you really need to be thinking about your advertising early on as part of your marketing message, because you're going to need to do that. Because Apple will not love you in 99.9% of the cases the way a lot of other channels, because I think that's the problem, is that because a lot of these media centers, including games, have grown up with the idea that there's a channel, like a curated channel that someone... you submit to, and they look at it, and they're like, oh, this is good, and we're going to promote this, and we'll have this little festival, or we'll have this station, or we'll have this like magazine where we're going to put you up there and not these other people. That's not the way these marketplaces work. These marketplaces, basically, they have a checklist to make sure that you don't violate the list, and then you're on your own. So you need to think very early on about how you're going to create distribution yourself. The good news is there's like to the examples we were talking about before, other kinds of distribution, you can do that with apps too. You can buzz with apps, you can get attention to apps. Yeah. Especially if you have a web component, you can draw to the web component that draws to the app. There's a lot of techniques to do that, and if you can, you know, if you really want to get to the nuances of advertising, if you can micro-target your advertising, you can actually do the advertising very cheaply and effectively, but you need to be thinking about that very early on, because if you just launch the app and you just, like, let it go, there's a very good chance it will just drown in the sea of other good but
un-advertised apps. There's more apps made than films made every years.
Just one really quick thing. It's really what you said about advertising. It's really important that you have advocates, like people and culture curators that you can kind of talk to about your product, your movie, or whatever it is ahead of time. So like look at some blog leaders and try to get on their radar somehow. And New York is the place to be for this stuff because there's so many meetups, creative mornings, all these places that people come to. If you can start meeting these people one-on-one, if they become your advocates, then I think you can have at least some level of success or at least some level of hits on these things. So, because I don't know how Facebook advertisement works, but it's really, so to me it was really difficult to really see how it works because it's a lot of money involved in that, and we never had any money. So social currency also goes along.
And Bassam, you make a good point about finding hubs and influencers to appeal to who are going to be your evangelists. And finding them and engaging them is an important part of the process. And I know that for some of my clients that I work with as a strategist, I do a lot of work with clients around listening. Like, are you listening to your landscape? And also, a lot of early stage transmedia ventures, even at the beginning stages, might have a Facebook page or a splash page. And these tools are great as research and development. As you roll into your project, as you're developing your project, you're also cultivating your audience and your evangelists. So I just wanted to add to that in case anybody wanted
to. Going back to that, this is a very libertarian saying, and I'm not libertarian, but when you're doing an app or something like that, you got to think like that and say, people won't do anything because it helps you. They're only going to do it if it helps themselves. And like, I keep on working with clients who want to make an app, and it's just, you know, some junk about their film. And that doesn't help me do anything in my life whatsoever. So I'm not going to use that app. But if you give me an app that lets me do something that in some way makes my life better, even if that's just be able to remember to get your film later or something, whatever it is, but you've got to think of what are they going to do with this. And so it's usually more not about your film, but about something you want people to do, or that, you know, let's, you know, like, for example, there's a film being made called When I Walk, about a guy who's slowly losing his ability to walk. And he's made thing called Access Map. And it's promoting his film, of course, but what he really wants to do is have people with disabilities log in at restaurants and bars and movie theaters and put in user-based information on how accessible that venue is. That's going to probably take off pretty well because it's very useful to people with disabilities. It also happens to promote his film in some ways, but there's a much bigger purpose for it. And those are the ones I think will work.
But I should also just say that, like, natural organic internet growth is explosive, right? And it's just, if you just look at networking theory and the way networking theory works, you will see like the patterns of the way things explode on the internet follows networking theory perfectly.
What's networking theory?
Well, like the idea that like you start in like these little hubs that have like little connections to other hubs, but then you eventually hit connectors who are connected to lots of hubs, and then things just kind of blow up in these like, these almost like you know, like meteors hitting the earth and killing the dinosaurs kind of ways. Like this, like the world will suddenly change because all of a sudden, like I mean, I think the model you described is really the model of success, where like it's small for a while, and then all of a sudden, Boing Boing covers it, and then you're in a new level.
Yeah.
And then it's like sort of floating in a whole bunch of other consciousness, and then you get to CNN, and it's floating in a new level, and that the change it's not a gradual curve. It's like sudden shocks up.
Ups and downs too.
Dynamics. The transmedia is a complex adaptive dynamic system, right?
Yes. I'm primarily a writer and a filmmaker. I'm working on two projects at the moment, both of which will become possibly a book and a film each, and both involve two different forms of environmental crime. My background is in environmental science, and I understand these things pretty well. It's a lot of the stuff happens in Africa, in places where information is very short supply, bandwidth is an extremely short supply, but a lot of people see a lot of things. And I have an idea of essentially crowdsourcing information on these two different forms of environmental crime. I don't really want to be a coder. I have an idea of what this thing might look like. Where do I find the kind of people who would help me make that side of it possible? Because I've done all this research on these books and these stories, and I understand what's going on pretty well, but there's this enormous opportunity for a type of site like you're describing, about the sort of disabled thing, where people could generate very useful information, you know, about their everyday lives and potentially change a political landscape in certain countries. But I don't know where to go to find trusted, good, no bullshit people to work with to make this happen.
So the question's around the collaborative process and where one begins. And I remember this question coming up last year at the BAVAC Producers Summit in New York, almost 1 year ago, January of last year. And people were talking about the need for folks working strategically, like I do, sort of connecting people. Mm-hmm. Sometimes there are individuals or small design shops that actually have grants or programs or labs, so that there is an easier entry all the way up, obviously, to the the larger levels, but I would imagine you might have something to say about that topic.
I kind of don't, actually. I mean,
where do we find if I'm a project? How do I get someone like you?
In other words, I think, I mean, that's a very hard question. I mean, you know, knowing people, I don't know how to even.
Well, one is applying to the Bayback Lab.
Yeah,
that's
example.
What is the Bayback Lab?
The Bay Area Video Coalition is an organization out of San Francisco, and they have a lab that you were part of. And what they do is they pair usually filmmakers and storytellers with technologists who can help them implement some aspect of what they're trying to do. And it's very practical, right? You go in for like 1 week and you tell them what you do.
So I've been there for on a project, maybe like three projects as well as an advisor. And it kind of, the funding kind of stopped last year, but they're continuing it. So you should go to their website, bavc.org. Mm-hmm. And then you can find out more. But I mean, what I mean is the probably best way is I get referred to by a lot of people actually, and that's through attending those. But to go when you're putting together a team for something, a workshop like that, be it the new the storytelling lab at Sundance where we met actually.
Yeah.
These programs will help, but I think the best is to, you know, if you see something that's great, you kind of contact the people who made it and then find.
I haven't seen anything that looks like what I want to do, though.
Right.
You know, because a part of what I want to do involves enormous amounts. I mean, one of the projects in particular is information that, you know, people are actively trying to suppress. Mm-hmm. And there's very, very few examples I've seen. I mean, it's one thing to sort of say, oh, I couldn't get my wheelchair up the ramp at this bar, right? Everybody knows that, everybody's seen that. Nobody's going to live or die because of that. But you know, when you're in situations where people are, you know, trying to kill people to stop information coming out, but yet there are a lot of people who actually know about it, and it would be very powerful for it to be, you know, crowdsourced, for example. That gets a little more difficult.
I just want to make one recommendation to just everybody in the room who's interested in this: learn to code. It's not that hard. I mean, it's not easy, and I'm not saying that you're going to learn to code so that you can build the project yourself, because that you're probably not going to do if you're not a programmer. But learning to prototype something on an iPhone is not hard. It really isn't. Get one book. Go to a Barnes & Noble if you're that Luddite. Get the book out of the Barnes & Noble, right? Read the book. Code the thing. It's not that bad. You can put together off the top of my head. I mean, any of the O'Reilly books are great. They're like really simple, but I mean, if you want something that's going to be like really like iPhone for Dummies, there is an iPhone for Dummies book, and there are also books that are about like making your first iPhone game and stuff like that. And anything like that will help you, because what you really just need to do. I'm sorry, I teach new media a lot, and I teach in a digital program, and I'm someone who wasn't a programmer who kind of taught myself a little bit how to program for these very purposes. Is just getting over the fear of programming, which is like that fear of math you had, which is just that, like, this isn't for me, and I'm not logical enough, or I'm not, I'm not geeky enough to really get this. Like, I'm a creative, and this math stuff is hard, right? Like, it's like, just do it. It's like the first time you actually, like, started to do craft, and you didn't know what you were doing. And, like, you had to hammer a nail into a board and measure the board, and you were like, I don't know how to do this, and then you did it a few times, and you wasted a few boards, and you wasted a few nails, and eventually you got sort of decent at measuring, and then you could finally, like, build that birdhouse. That's what you do with code. It's no different. It's literally no different than any other craft you have ever worked on in your entire life. You're going to mess it up, and it's going to be frustrating and slow, but eventually you're going to get comfortable with it, and then you're going to wonder to yourself why on earth this was so scary in the first place. And the sooner you jump that hurdle to getting a prototype, the so much easier all of this gets, because instead of going into a pitch meeting with somebody and having this like beautiful little deck that shows pictures of stuff, and then trying to convince them that someday you're actually going to bridge that gap, you go to them with something on a screen that actually sort of works, and they can tap it, and they can play around with themselves, and the vision that gives somebody is so much bigger than anything else you could do that it's worth that kind of
Excuse
investment.
Me, but weren't you just saying half an hour ago that you shouldn't try and do everything yourself?
That's not doing everything yourself. Wait. That's not doing everything yourself. Building a prototype is not doing everything yourself, right? Like, if you're going to, you know, writing a script isn't making a film, you know? It's like, I'm talking about something very basic, something very simple. Anybody in this room who spent an hour a day trying to do this could do it in 4 months.
Well, one of the challenges for us is we knew a lot of good designers and coders, but we just simply didn't have the money to do it. And so there's a site called Elance.com, which, like any site, has pros and cons. And what it is it kind of works like eBay, where you post a job and say, hey, I need a designer to do this, and it needs to look exactly like this. I need it to do this. This is my project. This is what I'm trying to get across. And all these designers and coders and graphic artists, whoever, they bid on the project. You can look at their profiles. You can look at their reputation. You can see their portfolio, and you engage them directly. And it's safe, it's secure, and all this other stuff. And that's actually what we use. Instead of spending thousands of dollars to design our site, we spent a few hundred.
What's it called again?
Elance.com.
I'm going to get some other voices in the room. This gentleman has had his hand up for a while.
I want to ask a very different kind of question. It's also a difficult question, in part because I should spend more time trying to articulate it. And maybe a good answer would be this person or that person is already writing about this issue and writing about it intelligently. That would be useful to me. But there has been an idea in our culture, off and on, hasn't been very successful, of a counterculture, and the idea that if you were going to be successful in social change or left-leaning sort of things, it would have to be counter the culture, because, you know, Darfur, to pick your example, is not something that just happened out of the blue. It happened for various economic reasons. So, and then you have this thing in new media where the attachment to the culture or to the economic system is so strong, and when you hear the language of this conversation, it has, you know, people have already talked about the blurring of lines between commercial campaigns versus social change campaigns and how those can look very similar, and, you know, people working with Microsoft, you know, etc. So how are there people who are thinking their way through this maze or this mess or whatever to say, you know, if we're interested actually in something different, how do we position ourselves?
So if I understand you, and thank you for your comment, because these are interesting, prescient points. If I understand your question, it's around, like, are there thought leaders that are considering kind of the chaos and the blurring of the lines from...
And maybe ways, you know, thinking about even just what the problem is might be a start, or just even just naming the problem might be a start. But it's just something that I'm...
Well, Lance Weiler, who I mentioned earlier, has a website that he runs called Workbook Project. And Workbook Project, several different artists contribute pieces on, you know, all these blurring of lines and transmedia and where it's going. And they also, Lance has DIY Days, which is all about, you know, that bigger counterculture thing you're talking about. So that's one place I would start to find the people thinking about that and talking about it. And his conference, which will be in New York probably in like March, I think. Is that right, Ingrid?
Yeah.
There's usually people who are thinking about this and talking about this. I'm sure there's others, but that's top of my head.
Hi.
Hi. Did you, between your business model slides and your comment about the upkeep and maintenance, the ongoing, the project lasts forever, did you finish discussing how one goes about addressing the funding issue over an unforeseen amount of time? Like how, if you have to keep up and maintain your site, your project, or whatever.
So the question is, you know, Brian touched on business models. Takaaki talked about the ongoing nature of these platforms, that they're not finite. Like, I finished my film, it's out in the world, now people buy tickets. And there's obviously a gap there. I think that Brian touched on also that there are a lot of funding sources in terms of foundation money, but more importantly, these need to segue into models of monetization, right? So there is a huge gray area around sponsorship integration, places where, you know, they're very delicate, though, because you're crossing a line between sort of, you know, advertising and editorial in the old school world, but we're also seeing places where there's branded content and all kinds of versions of companies that actually do have stories to tell or would like to align themselves with people telling stories, obviously negotiating where the buck stops in terms of who's having an impact on the content versus who's paying for it is extremely complex territory. As a strategist, I kind of work in that realm all the time, and there's no single or easy answer.
Yeah, it's project by project. I mean, you know, you could say this about the 30 days thing or the access map thing. I mean, there's all these projects where you go, that would be great if it lasted 30 years. And that's what I would consider success, is when it could last 30 years. But, you know, sponsorship and foundation money is going to go away at some point, no matter what it is, because they're mercurial and they change what they are thinking about all the time. So you've got to figure out, and I don't know what the answer is, what's the business model that could potentially keep this going? And both of those, I could see eventually where you get enough user base that you could have advertising that would bring enough money to keep it going. I could foresee a world where the premium version of the access map is something that users want enough that they pay $1 a year for, and it keeps the maintenance and upkeep going. I don't know that either one of those projects have thought about that, but I mean, you have to look at what you're doing and figure out, like, how do I keep, I mean, I think this is the great question for everyone doing these projects to figure out. Because you know certain sources of money are going away, but they're still valuable to have. And I don't know the answer. It's a case-by-case basis and trial and error. Everyone's trying it. You know, it'd be great if eventually one of those grows into an organization where people are feeling like they want to contribute to all the time to keep it going. But that also goes back to, how do we make this useful enough to our users that it helps their lives enough that they're going to want to keep doing this?
And I'm happy to talk about it more afterward, too, because I have some clients that are looking at coalitions or consortiums of strategic partners, and then there are models that are kind of open up potential there.
I mean, it's probably as in flux as all this stuff is right now, I think. Some of the things I heard about is filmmakers who also have these kind of projects trying to create, so that the organization itself is not only just making films and that's how they're getting funding, but sort of a continue, like, and not to, I mean, just so it's more immediate than, you know, before the funding runs out. The idea is to have an organization that creates films as well as all these interactive projects, that the money gets into that organization and it kind of gets pulled into different places so they can maintain film work as well as all the other stuff that's going on, instead of saying, okay, this money goes to the film.
Maybe one more, and then
they'll be informal, we'll be around. Yes.
I had a question about how the sort of film world, in terms of festivals, is kind of handling this area. In part, because, I mean, you've seen, like, Toronto having future projections and New Frontiers and Sundance, and then I guess the Transmedia and Tribeca and stuff. Because it, in a sense, it seems like when there is so much, the role of the curator and the programmer is actually more important nowadays. Maybe not in terms of giving a check platform in the traditional sense, but certainly everyone does watch, you know, what these sort of name right. brands put up. So I'm wondering what you all sort of see as where that's going.
It's a great question around the more traditional film world. The festivals, we sort of pay attention to them. They're programmed. Some of them are getting up to speed. I know that Nick and Takaki, you guys met at the Sundance in August. Did it have a name?
The New Frontier Story Lab.
Right. So the same way that Sundance has like a director's lab and a producer's lab and a bunch of other labs, they now have a lab that is moving into Transmedia. And August was the first year for it.
Yeah,
right?
And the Story Lab was, by the way, the coding resource that I've been trying to think of this whole time is called the Code Academy. You can find it online. And they're doing something right now called the Code Year, where they'll teach you how to program JavaScript over your computer.
I'm doing it.
Is that yours?
No, I'm doing it. I think you're doing it too, aren't you, Andrew?
Yeah. Super, super awesome. Awesome site. Just teaches you how to program JavaScript really simply. And if you learn how to program JavaScript, it will be a door to other things. So the Story Lab is a... It was really a meeting place between like writers and directors and people working in new media in this very broad and I think as necessary kind of like you know, just sort of like throw everybody in a box and shake the box and see what happens kind of way, which was really terrific. And actually 18 Days in Egypt was one of the pieces that was there, which was really great because we got to meet the people working on that and talk to them about it. And it was really, I think it was a rewarding opportunity for everybody because, you know, people, you know, you would have these, it was beautiful, you'd have these people present, you'd have the fellows present, and they would get up and they would talk about their work, and then there would be this whole, this wave from one side of the room that was like, I don't know how true your story is, I think you really need to develop out these characters more, I'm like trying to find like what the heart of this is that is going to appeal to people, and the other side of the room was like, I don't know how you navigate that website you've got, and it was great because we would sort of like look over the wall to each other and be like, oh, there's like all this stuff I've never really thought that hard about. over there. And I think that kind of support was the most valuable thing to me about that. And I think a lot of those places do. I know that Toronto's been sponsoring this forever through Habitat at the or what was called Habitat. I don't even know what it's called now, but like there was a whole group in Toronto that was specifically focused on games and games relationship to new media projects around this. So I know that they've been very interested in that in the Toronto film scene for a while. And South By has always had this sort of like, has its sort of like little crazy interactive corner that's doing this kind of work. I think it's great. I mean, we met. It's awesome for that. And I think the value of that can't be understated.
But I was just at a conference of film festival organizers and programmers. And there are definitely people like Tribeca, Sundance, Toronto, other places that are doing some of this. But, you know, we tried to have a conversation as part of a panel about the future of film fests, about, are, you know, people interested in this. And a room of 300 festival programmers, there was like two hands that cared at all. And, you know, it's just not on the radar of a lot of them. And so you'll find, I've had this with clients that have had a project they want to do that's really cool. They want to do something like they would do at New Frontier. And the festival's like, no way, dude, because that's just too much brain space for me to dedicate. So if you want to do it, you're going to have to do it on your own. And you're in charge of it. And I'll show your movie, but I'm not doing anything else. That might change a little bit, but right now you're only going to find these pockets. The good thing right now is you can find these pockets, and it's a small community. You know, like I wasn't at that lab, but I was advising them in advance of who they should invite to come to the thing. And everyone's talking to each other. I mean, Ingrid's here, and she's leading what Tribeca's doing in transmedia. And, you know, so it's a small enough world now that you can meet people really quick. And that goes back to your question. Like, go to these places where these things are going on, because you start hanging out with people and it's, you know, they're like, oh, I want to work with your cool project. You know, and that's how you meet them. And that's how I found I'm launching a new thing that has a very tech-heavy component. And I met a guy from Australia at one of these things, and he's building that part of it for us.
And just to say that, like, I can't stress the importance of sometimes these organizations or these grants, because, like, I'm working on a documentary, and we had no legitimacy until, like, Sundance gave us a grant, and then we were invited to the festival to talk about our film and stuff like that. Then people actually cared about what we were doing. So sometimes just going in and be like, yeah, I got a film, it's like, okay, why do I care? But it's like sometimes the pedigree of an institution or something like that, whether it's good or bad, just goes a long way. So it's just the realities of life, I guess.
I don't want to end on a negative note on this, based on what you're saying about film festival programmers. And, you know, you go to these things. I mean, IDFA also has their little nook of, and we had our stuff, Condition One had our stuff in there, but there's something fundamentally kind of wrong about that presentation. You go in there, like, all this shit's going on. Like, they're not, like, there's so much shit going on, and, like, some projects are definitely not meant for that format to be sitting there as, like, a thing that you touch and someone's talking to and you're trying to figure it out. It's like, you actually never really get to experience the thing. And I think that just totally falls flat. Like, it's not, if they're designed as such, as an installation, then it makes sense, but a lot of these things aren't, and it's kind of, you have to create a whole other thing to present it, and it's like, why?
Yeah, I mean, that's... I agree completely. Like, sometimes you'll, and I love Sundance, I'm not being mean to them whatsoever. Like, you go to the New Frontier, and sometimes you're like, okay, this is the circus, there's some weird shit going on, what's going on? You can't really get into it, and other times it can be great. But I think that's another thing about transmedia, though. Like, the reason we had film fests in different communities was because, like I used to run the Atlanta Film Fest, and before the Atlanta Film Fest came around 30 years ago, 40 years ago, you weren't going to see independent films unless they brought it there. Well, with transmedia, you don't need that festival to reach a million people. You can get your transmedia out to millions of people and never step foot in Sundance. And so, in a weird way, in some ways you don't need them, although they can definitely give support and everything else. And I'm not saying let's kill all the festivals by any means. I'm just saying, you know, we don't necessarily need that structure for some of these projects.
But it draws back to this point that, like, you know, when we talk about transmedia, like, we in that phrase, we're talking about things that absolutely fit in these festivals and things that absolutely don't fit in these festivals and things that would be wasted in the festival and could go someplace else. So I think part of it is that, like, a film is a known quantity. It's a 90 to, you know, 150-minute experience that you watch quietly in a room. And, like, since that's a reliable thing, you can kind of build something around that can house thousands of them in a way that's sensible. But, like, when you're talking about, like, event-based versus non-event-based, I think that's one of the really critical ones. What kind of technology do you need to walk in the door with? Like, how individuated versus group-oriented is a project? Like, all that stuff, like, becomes really meaningful about presentation, and I think... until we genrefy more, it's going to be really hard to contain us in a box, but I'm really happy to be living in the point where we're not genrefied yet.
Yeah, like your Granito project. Exactly. Granito is like the perfect example. I'm in the film world, and I know those guys really well. And I guarantee you, if I go into Sundance, South by, anywhere else, 99% of the audience has no idea all the other stuff you guys were doing.
Right.
But it was still important stuff to be done, and it had probably a bigger impact than winning an award. Well, you know, winning an award at Sundance or something. But, so they know, like, okay, we position. It's almost like the platform for us to get things on our resume and to raise awareness with a certain community is Sundance and the Oscars and everything else.
Right.
But then there's 20 other platforms we need to be on that they don't even care about.
Yeah.
And we're still going to do them because it's going to have an impact.
I think that's a fantastic note to end on. I want to thank all of our guests one more time.